he made the comment that that Sherry and I have been singing and preaching together for 20 years or so. She can preach really well, so that part of it is true. I can't sing worth a lick, and so there hasn't. We actually sang once together in public, and that was we were completing a time in a church in Virginia Beach, Colonial Baptist in Virginia Beach. We just ended about maybe 8 years of ministry there. And so one of our final services, they actually were recording it. And what it was Sherry was, she's done a few CDs and has done a lot with the Wilds and a few solo CDs. And so they were recording her whole service, and they were actually going to put it out as a live CD and market it and go from there. So they had all kinds of recording equipment, everything going on. And so she did all these songs, and people sang with her, and it was wonderful. And I sang one song with her, just one. And so I got up, and if you know the song, May the Lord Find Us Faithful, it was written by Mac Lynch. Mac and Beth were dear friends of ours, and so actually Sherry was Mac's secretary for several years down at the Wilds, and then I lived with Mac and Beth in their basement for a period of time. And so Mac wrote that song, and about the same time we met, and so we kind of took that as our personal song. So we got up, and we actually sang that together as a duet in that service. Great fun. The minute the song was over, I went and sat down, and our pastor got up afterwards and walked up and leaned into the microphone and said, "That won't be on the CD." And so, you know, it was just this meaningful moment for me. It just busted all of that. Everyone laughed, and it was legitimately funny. And actually listening to me sing is legitimately funny also. All right, last night was this intense, passionate plea that if I have one goal in life, it is to communicate, quite honestly, what I said last night. That's it. So, you know, on my tombstone, if they mark the words "life is ministry, ministry is global," I'm good with that. And if everywhere I go, people walk away with that idea and the recognition that for there to be a fruitful life, there has to be a selfless death. If that's what I'm known for, I will rest in peace in the arms of my Savior. So we went through this, and I recognize it was, especially on a Friday night after long days, it's this intense kind of study that is given, and you end talking about death, and you end talking about, you know, the jungles of Ecuador and people dying, and there's a certain sense in which you walk out and you go, yeah, I know all that's true, but the reality is I really don't want to die in Ecuador. I just kind of want to live in Indiana. And so what does that mean for me? So what we need to do today is we actually kind of need to come back from the jungles of Ecuador and take the idea of life as ministry, ministry is global. For there to be a fruitless life, there must be a selfless death. And we kind of need to flesh it out and what it looks like to actually to live and to live in real life. And what does that kind of life look like when you're not going to, when God doesn't have that for you? Now, with that said, I will say this. I was thinking about this and actually praying about this morning as the rain was coming down. I recognize that certainly not everyone in this room will go and serve on a foreign field in that kind of a context. But I can't help but think that in a room of 50 of those that have dedicated their life to the Lord, that certainly there would be one or two or maybe a tenth, maybe five, that would be in this room that 10 years from now will be serving the Lord in that kind of a context. Now, I don't know who those five are. Maybe you don't know who those five are yet either. Maybe you don't know if it's you. But I would certainly hope that there would be one or two or more of you that the Lord would thrust out as a seed under the fertile fields, and He would plant you somewhere, and you would allow yourself to be crushed for the sake of the gospel so that the heathen can know their Redeemer lives. But many of us won't do that. Many of us, for God's good purposes, He has left us here I'm certainly one of those. There have been many times when I have said, Lord, go, let me go, let me go. We had plans all in place, and the Lord just said, no, no, not yet at least. And I still say not yet. I still hold out hope that eventually he'll let us go. Until then, we have to live out a life that is, if I can put it this way, is mundane. That's normal. So today what I'd like to do is I'd like to kind of come back to reality to a certain extent and work through a book, and we already mentioned it last night, the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth addresses life in a small, if I can put it this way, Midwestern town. This morning, specifically, and I think I said this even last night, I'm going to warn you, this morning is going to be 45 minutes or 35 minutes of introduction. Okay? Then there's going to be some application that is made in the second session, and then we're going to kind of hit the climax in the third session. So if you sense at the end of this morning that he really didn't do anything but kind of lay a context and a groundwork, that would be accurate. And so my goal right now is just merely context, and to a certain extent it's going to be information overload. I'm kind of banking on the fact that maybe you're awake right now and I can kind of pummel you with information, and then we're going to have to do a whole lot more application, a lot more storytelling as the day goes on and as the mind starts to shut down just a little bit. So let's go to the book of Ruth. Book of Ruth, chapter 1. I already mentioned this is one of my favorite little stories. It has so many different factors in it. If you are given to dramatic arts at all, the Book of Ruth makes one of the best short stories and one of the best four-act plays, I think, that could ever be written. And so much could be said about it. If you actually kind of do the comparisons, chapter 1 and chapter 3 parallel one another, chapter 2 and chapter 4 parallel one another, and at the same time, chapter 1 and chapter 4 have choruses, and so you have the same people speaking. Chapter 2 and chapter 3 have internal reflections of one another. It's called the chiastic structure, where they actually kind of structure. They're mirror images of one another. So this thing is written in such a way, it's a tightly woven, beautiful story. Our goal right now, I don't think we're going to get much beyond the first five verses, but we're going to see if we can get through the first five verses at least. It begins like this. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Now, the name of the one was Elimelech, and the name of the other was name of his wife was Naomi. And the name of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephraimites of Bethlehem, Judah. They went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took two wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Now, as good students of the Bible, you're going to read those first five verses, and you're going to recognize there is a ton of information in those first five verses that really provide the entire backdrop. And it is so easy for us to kind of, all right, I got like the first five down, now let me get into the story. But for the original readers, the information in those first five verses is going to provide all of the framework and all really of the emotion for the rest of the story. So we actually have to stop and kind of go word for word for word through these first five verses and see if we can set the framework. Because really, the framework is going to be important. The first five verses are the picture. And when you look at a picture, I'm a Norman Rockwell fan. When you look at a picture, you know, the old saying is a picture says 1,000 words. So you can look at that picture and immediately you have a context for exactly what's happening. You can look at that picture. And again, a story is told just via the picture. You can look at that picture. And just with colors on canvas, an entirely different story is told than the previous two. You can look at that picture. And again, your emotional response between picture number 3 and picture number 4 is going to be distinctly diverse. Now, words do the same thing. Words communicate pictures to us. And the introduction of a book provides us a framework. A lot of books we actually know by their first lines. Just think for a moment. Call me Ishmael. All right, let's see who the lit majors are here. Book? Moby Dick. Very good. Second one, and if a guy knows this, all right, girls don't answer this. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. All right, guys, what book?
Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice?
Yes.
Gals?
Yes.
Yes? Good. How many have read Pride and Prejudice? How many have seen the movie? Most have seen the movie at that point. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, and it was the winter of despair. Book is? I actually really love that book. Great, great book. First words set the framework as far as the entire book is concerned. Let's stop and think about the first words of Ruth. Let me take, if I can, actually to the Bethlehem Herald, June 2nd, 1213. That would be before Christ, B.C. These would be the headlines as far as the daily newspaper are concerned. Sad day, remember. Today marks the 25th anniversary of the brutal murder and rape of Rachel, daughter of Simeon of Bethlehem. This brutal murder and rape was followed by a sorrowful civil war against our neighbors to the north, the tribe of Benjamin. Over 40,000 Israelites and an additional 25,000 Benjamites were slain in a period of 12 hours as the wrath of the children of Israel responded to the terrible tragedy. We, the inhabitants of Bethlehem, are most sorrowful since it was the harlotry of one of our own which sparked this unfortunate incident. That would have been the headlines. I'll continue just kind of reading headlines so we have a sense of the context of, in which Ruth was written. Second story would read something like this. Invasion imminent. According to top sources at the Defense Department, the Midianites have been spotted gathering the forces for their yearly invasion through our land. This will mark the third straight year these marauders have swept through the land, stealing our precious food and taking our few animals. If this invasion is not stopped soon, the ongoing famine will claim the lives of each other. Of us. Paper continues. Baal tribute. In order to do our part to stop the famine, the priests of Baal have added an additional worship service to the great god of fertility. Cultist priests or cult priestesses will be available for worship 4 days a week. See, this is what would have been talked about as far as the streets of Bethlehem at that point in time. Playoffs. The Bethlehem bread makers did not fare well in Game 6 of the playoffs. They were run over by the tire tubes, 103-89. King James had 33 points, 10 rebounds, and 8 assists. They had sports back then. And I'm not making any predictions, by the way, as far as this evening is concerned. City council member moving. Elimelech scheduled a news conference today to announce that he and his family were moving to Moab. The announcement comes as a surprise to all. He stated that he plans to stay in Moab until the famine ends. Because of this, he's keeping his property in Bethlehem. His two sickly sons, Mahlon and Chilion, his wife Naomi, will accompany him. She of the four will be greatly missed. Her friendly smile and even her faith in the old God of Joshua are an encouragement to us all. And then finally, back in the classifieds, would read something like this. Levite position open immediately. Proper lineage and some knowledge of the Mosaic law required. Small home provided. Pay is minimal. No experience necessary. Send resume to the city council of Bethlehem, Judah. Now, we stop and we go, really? Yeah, really. These are real people. Living in real time and interacting with the news of the day. And really what we have in the first five verses is a communication of those types of facts. So what we're going to do is, again, we're going to put our mind into a little bit of a Bible class mode, and let's just walk through. And a lot of this I put on PowerPoint just so we can kind of stay with it. Let's just walk through dates, places, people, pace, and situation and mood. Let's set the whole mood as far as the book is concerned. Then we'll go from there. Let's go back to the story. It says, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. All right, stop right there. The days when the judges ruled. What do we know about the days when the judges ruled? All right, just real quick. Everyone does what's right in their own eyes. All right, roughly, give me the time frame. How long was it that the judges ruled? Number? Guess? Anyone? someone says between 350 and 450 years, they're probably about right on there. All right, we'll roughly say roughly around 400 years. So from the time of Joshua to the time of the establishment, as far as the Davidic kingship is concerned, really Saul before David, you had roughly around 350, 400 years. So everyone is doing what's right in their own eyes. There's about 350 to 400 years, and there's this cycle that's taking place. And you know this. We can sit there and we can go through the book of Judges, and you see this cycle of sin, servitude, supplication. Then there's a savior or salvation comes, followed by service, and then followed by sin again. And there's this constant cycle that is taking place. You have all these judges, and these judges primarily are going to be regional. We're not sure, but we don't think that there was ever a particular judge that actually freed the entirety of the country. Most of them probably did regions, some of them even overlapped by way of time. It's a good indication that maybe Samson and Samuel were actually contemporaries one of the other. So they would have known one another. At least there would have been some level of interaction between the two. And as said frequently, particularly at the end of the book of Judges, there's no king in Israel, so everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. So that is the temperature, the spiritual temperature of the land. All right, keep that in mind. So when Ruth says this right from the beginning, when the author says, this is the time of the judges, that's what you should be thinking. All right, keep that in the forefront. Moab. It says that they went to dwell in the country of Moab. End of verse 1. All right, again, we got to stop for a moment. What do we know about Moab? Let's go real back. What are the back to the roots. What are the roots of Moab? Lot. All right, remember the story? By the way, there's a couple of really sad stories that I'm going to tell this morning, but they're just biblical. Let's go all the way back to Lot. His wife turns into a pillar of salt as they leave Sodom and Gomorrah. They end up in a cave. He has two daughters. They seemingly stay in the cave for a period of time, and we're not real sure why. Why didn't they just go back to Uncle Abraham? And we don't know whether it's shame or what motivated this, but Lot's there with his two daughters, and his two daughters start growing concerned that Lot is never going to leave the cave, and because of that, they're going to be barren because they're never going to have interaction with men, so they get their father drunk. Then they get impregnated with their father, and there are two countries that come out of that. And those two countries are Edom and Moab. So you have the roots of Moab being, keep this in mind, a older man who was drinking, who went to sleep, who then a younger woman came to him at night and was impregnated by him for the sake of the perpetuation of lineage. Okay, just keep that in mind. That's the ancestry. What else do we know about them? Well, more current history, as far as Ruth is concerned, in Moses' day, we know that Moab paid Balaam to curse Israel. And when that didn't work, if you remember the whole Balaam story, then what Moab did is they stopped and they took a number of their women and they sent them down to the camp. And the whole goal was to seduce the men of Israel. And they figured if they couldn't conquer them by a curse, they could conquer them by intermarriage. So they sent their women down. Because they sent their women down, again, God cursed Moab. And that curse in Moab led to this. A proclamation in the Mosaic law that simply said this: no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever. So, in other words, a Moabitess, Israel, oil and water, weren't going to happen. Shouldn't happen. Why? Well, look at their history. These are not people that you would want your daughter to date. These are not people that you would want your son to date. These are bad people from a historical perspective, from a theological perspective. So when we read Time of the Judges, everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. All of a sudden we read Moab and we go, oh no, what in the world's this? Okay, let's keep going. Bethlehem, Judah. What do we know about Bethlehem, Judah? Well, we know archaeologically this is a small town. Obviously, it's south of Jerusalem, but at this point in time, Jerusalem's not even established. Okay? This is long before David ever goes there. Well, a lot of us, when we think of Bethlehem, what do we think of? Oh, Jesus was born there. Sweet little town, manger. Okay, get that out of your mind. right, we've got a long way to go before we get to Jesus. This is a little farming community, maybe 5,000 people, and they had a particular reputation. And it's that reputation I want to spend just a little bit more time on, because, again, that's going to set the context for the story here. Original readers, when they read Bethlehem, Judah, they immediately something came to mind. So let's go back to the book of Judges. There's two stories. Who, by the way, who's the last judge that's recorded in the book of Judges? His name? Long hair, then bald Samson. Okay? So the last judge that is recorded is Samson. But Samson actually dies in the end of chapter 16. And we still have five chapters to go. There's actually two stories at the end of the book of Judges. So let's go back to those two stories. Pick it up in chapter 17. Chapter 17. Now, I'm not going to tell all of these stories. It take too long. But I'm going to rush through them. And you're going to have to kind of accept the trainer translation of them. But I'll point out the key facts as we go here. All right, let's pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 17. This is is a funny story. So you kind of have to smile through it. Now, there was a man of the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 of shekels of silver that were taken from you, on which you put a curse, even saying in my ear, here is the silver with me, I took it." And his mother said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my son." All right, what just happened there? All right, what just happened is this mother has 1,100 shekels of silver. That's a lot of dough, by the way. It's a lot of money. Even for us today, much less back then. So, 1,100 shekels of silver gets stolen. And she said, "Cursed is the person who stole my silver." And then her son comes around and says, "Mom, oh, by the way, I stole it." And her response to it is, "Well, bless you, my son." Now, you got to read that. You have to go, what in the world is going on here? These people don't know right from wrong. So, they take the silver, and see what they do with it. After she says, "Blessed be the Lord," verse 3, "So when he returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, 'I have wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord, for my son, to make a carved image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return it unto you.'" What just happened there? I'm taking this silver, and I'm dedicating it to the Lord. And as I'm dedicating it to the Lord, now I'm making it an idol. So when you read these three verses, you should sit there and just scratch your head and go, these people are clueless. They dedicate it to the Lord, and then they form an idol out of it. Okay, so they form this idol. Right, now, I'm going to keep moving as far as the story is concerned. Now they have this idol. They have an ephod, which is kind of a covering for the idol. And you've got a house. You've got money. You've got an idol. What do you need? You need a priest. You need a Levite now. So you can have your own personal Levite. So we'll keep reading just a little bit here. And we'll pick it up in verse 7. It says this. "Now there was a young man from" where? "Bethlehem in Judah. Of the family of Judah, he was a Levite and staying there. And this man departed from the city of" what? "Bethlehem, Judah, to stay where he could find a place. And he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and he sojourned. And Micah said to him, 'Where do you come from?' And he said, 'I am a Levite from Bethlehem, Judah.'" Now, just stop. Again, good Bible readers, you're looking at this. Where's this guy from? Bethlehem, Judah. Now, how many times do you have to hear that in three verses to actually know that? There's a purpose for the repetition. There's this man coming from Bethlehem, Judah, who happens to be a Levite from Bethlehem, Judah, who's sojourning from Bethlehem, Judah. All right, the author is making a point. And the point is, this guy is from Bethlehem, Judah. He doesn't want you to miss that. So Micah finds this guy, and this guy is a Levite. All right, let's stop again. A little bit of Old Testament history. When they went into the land, the land was divided amongst the tribes, but there was one tribe that wasn't giving any land, any allotment. And that tribe was Levi, because what they were going to do is they were going to be scattered amongst the people so they could make people aware of the law. And so every tribe was to basically take the Levites to house them, to supply money and food for them so that these individuals could be preaching the law, making them aware of what's right. Now, you have this guy, and later on we actually know his name's Jonathan. We have this guy who leaves Bethlehem, Judah. And basically, he's walking around Israel, and he's got this big sign that says, Levite for hire, Levite for hire. And Micah comes up to him and says, you're a Levite for hire? Yeah, I'm a Levite for hire. Where are you from? Bethlehem, Judah. Hey, would you like a job? Sure, I love a job. So they negotiate a price, and this man, this Levite from Bethlehem, Judah, becomes Micah's personal assistant Levite. So he's there, and this is almost funny. He's there to read the law of Moses as he worships the idol that Micah made. So this guy stands here in the house of Micah. Now chapter 18 is even more funny. And we won't take the time to read it, but basically what's happening here is this man is standing here, and he's helping Micah as far as his family worship is concerned, and then an entire tribe comes through, and as this entire tribe comes through, they go to this Levite, and they say, will you pray for us and tell us where we should go and whether we'll be successful? So this Levite prays for them and says, yes, you'll be successful. Go up north, conquer the land there. So they go up north, they conquer the land there. They come back, and they go, you know what? You're a pretty good Levite. How much is this guy paying you? He says, well, Micah's paying me this. He says, instead of being a Levite for one family, how would you like to be a Levite for the entire tribe? And Micah says, what will you pay me? Or Jonathan says, what will you pay me? And he says, we'll pay you this. And he looks at what Micah's paying him. He looks at what the tribe's paying him. He goes, I'll take you. So he takes the idol and the ephod, runs off with this tribe, and goes up north. Micah wakes up the next morning and says, who stole my Levite? And who took my idols? So he goes chasing after this tribe. Eventually he catches them. And as he catches them, the tribe turns around and says, do the math. How many are on your side and how many are on our side? And Micah stops and he goes, oh. And at the end of the chapter, Micah goes home and this Levite from Bethlehem, Judah goes to become the Levite for an entire tribe. Okay, end of story. It's chapter 17 and 18. All right, there's lots of truths we can develop from the story, but there's one thing I want us to remember in this. Bethlehem, Judah doesn't have a Levite. Okay? They have no one to make them aware of the law of God. Keep that in mind. Now, chapter 19. Another story. Oh, sickest story in the entire Old Testament from my perspective. I almost hate to read it in the context of a mourning, but it's scripture, so we're going to. Chapter 19, verse 1. And it came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, there was a certain Levite. Start noting the repeated themes here. Staying in the remote village of Ephraim. Repeated theme. And he took for himself a concubine from where? Lo and behold, Bethlehem of Judah. All of a sudden, this little dinky farming community all of a sudden just pops up again. And his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there four whole months. And her husband arose, went after her to speak kindly to her, to bring her back, having a servant and a couple of donkeys with him. So she brought him into the father's house. And when the father of the young woman saw her, he was glad to meet him. Now the father-in-law of the young woman detained him, stayed with him for 3 nights. So they ate and they drank and lodged there. Okay, now I'll summarize the story quickly. You have this Levite who has a concubine, okay, which is an illegal relationship according to the Mosaic law, has this concubine from Bethlehem, Judah. The concubine plays the whore against him. It's the way the text says it. She goes back home. He chases her down, goes to Bethlehem, Judah, and says, come back with me. Her father says, yep, not a problem. And so for 3 days, they stay there. He gets up one morning and says, I want to go back home. Father says, no, stay longer. Gets up, says, I want to go back home. Father says, no, stay longer. Gets up, says, I want to go home. Father says, no, stay longer. This goes 3 times. And finally, on the last day, this Levite says, I am going home. So he takes his concubine from Bethlehem, Judah. They get on their mules. They start heading back up north. As they're heading back up north, they go around Jerusalem. And as they're going around Jerusalem, they come to a place that, where they want to stay the evening. And when they come to that place, verse 18, and he says to him, speaking to an old man in the square, verse 17, where the question comes, where you come from, where are you going? Verse 18, we are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountain of Ephraim, and I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Do you see this repetition? Everything. Bethlehem, Judah. Bethlehem, Judah. Bethlehem, Judah. Now I'm going to the house of the Lord, but there is no one that will take me in. And then he goes on from there. The old man, verse 20, says, peace be unto thee. However, let all your needs be responsible. Only don't spend the night in the open square. Okay, so the old man takes him in. Let's go all the way down to verse 23. As they were enjoying themselves, this is the old man and the Levite. Suddenly, certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. Now, what does this remind you of, by the way? What Old Testament story? Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay? It's going to get ugly real quick here. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man to your who came to your house that we may know him. Okay, obviously speaking of in a carnal way. But the man, the master of the house went out to them and said, no, my brother, and I beg you, do not do so wickedly, seeing this man has come to my house. Do not commit this outrage. And what he says here is just sick. Look, here is my virgin daughter and this man's concubine. Bring them out to me, humble them, and do what you will, do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing. But the men would not heed it. So the man took his concubine. Now, note what happens here. The Levite takes his concubine and brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where the master was till it was light. And when his master rose in the morning and opened the doors and went out his way, there was his concubine fallen out the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said unto her, get up and let us be going. But there was no answer. So the man lifted her on the donkey and got up and went to his place. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. I'm sorry, that's a sad story. I don't have to repeat all the details of it. I think you got the details of it. I'm just going to ask one question. When did the woman die? When did the woman die? See, in every single Old Testament story, when someone dies, it always says, and they died. This one, it doesn't. So you're left with a level of ambiguity. You're left with the questioning. You're going, when did she die? Did she die because of the abuse of the evening? Or did she die when he stuck the knife in her and divided her up? We're not real sure. What we know is this, is the end of the story is this man divides her up, sends her out. All the representatives from Israel come along. They go to him and say, what's the story? And he lies to them. He's a Levite. He says, these people were trying to kill me. And then they took my concubine. And this is what they did. That's not what happened. They never said they were trying to kill him. And they didn't take his concubine. He threw her out. And then there's this massive civil war and lots of people die. Right, and that's really the end of the book of Judges. Key thought here is she is from Bethlehem, Judah. Now, go back to Ruth 1. What do we know about Bethlehem, Judah? During the time of the Judges, we know these two stories. 17 and 18, there's a mercenary Levite from Bethlehem, Judah. 19 through 21, there's a murderous Levite and a cut-up concubine from Bethlehem, Judah. Now, all of a sudden, you get to chapter 1 of the book of Ruth, and there's this story about Bethlehem, Judah. Right? There are certain cities in the world today, in our contemporary world, that everyone knows as wicked cities. They have particular reputations. There's actually one on every continent. Right? In North America, what is the city that is known as Sin City? Las Vegas. Okay, let's just see how you do from a geographical perspective. In Europe, what is Sin City? Amsterdam. In Asia, what is Sin City? Bangkok. In Africa, what is Sin City? Probably don't know this one. So Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Okay, every continent has a particular Sin City. Rio in South America, Sin City. All right, this is what I want you to catch here. In the Old Testament, when you talk about Bethlehem, Judah, it has a certain reputation. And everyone would know it. And you don't get long into this chapter with realizing There's a certain expectation when you're in Bethlehem, Judah. Nothing good happens in Bethlehem, Judah. Some people even suggest that Ruth represents what's called the Bethlehem Trilogy. It's the third story about Bethlehem, Judah. In the Judges, two stories, now Ruth. Right, so the setting here is going to be important. Right, what else do we know, just quickly, as far as the setting is concerned? The situation and the whole mood, one, there's a famine in the land, which means that it's a time of judgment. We know that via Deuteronomy. If there's a famine, it's a time of judgment. We know that they're sojourning to an unknown land. That's something that's against the Mosaic law. We know that there's barrenness among the women. How long were these two women, Orpah and Ruth, married, according to the first five verses? How long? 10 years. 10 years without producing. Personal testimony here. My wife and I have been married for 20 years. I've already shared with you. We got married when we were 29. We wanted to have children. That's the normal expectation. And so we wanted to have children. And since we were older, we were ready. At the end of the first year, the Lord didn't provide. That's okay. It's just year one. A little unusual, but that's okay. Into the second year, the Lord didn't provide. And, that's a little bit more challenging. So, you begin investigating. Into the third year, the Lord doesn't provide. And you've done your investigation. And there's still no fruit. And then you get into year four, and then you get into year five, and then you get into year six. And let me just say this, there is a sorrow that comes with that. A significant sorrow that comes with that. There is a sense of loss that comes with that. And by the time you get to year 10, you stop and you realize, God, this isn't going to happen. This isn't going to happen. And then there is an increased sorrow that comes with that. So, the 10 years here fly by quickly as far as our English text is concerned. But I don't want you to miss the expectation and the sorrow and the reality that this story is communicating. This is the death of all the men. They traded the famine for 3 funerals. That's exactly what Elimelech did. He said, I'm leaving the famine. And in 10 years, he dies and his 2 sons die. And what's left are 3 women who are wrestling with dearth, death, desertion, and destruction. They have nothing. Okay. Now, that's the setting for the book of Ruth. That establishes the expectations. If you were a playwright and you were putting this on as far as a 4-act play is concerned, when the curtain would go up, the stage would be set, and the way the stage would be set is it would be dark lights. You probably have the orchestra in the pit, and they'd be playing. It would be the basses and the cellos that would be playing. Probably something like, if you're a musician, like Gorecki's Third Song of Sorrows. And so you've got this symphony of sorrows that's being played in the background. A light's going to come on, and you're going to have this couple that's leaving their home, probably by way of silhouettes, people waving goodbye to them. They cross the stage. They go to Moab. There's a moment when the violins kick in as 2 weddings are celebrated, but those 2 weddings are immediately followed by funerals. And by the end of the scene, you have 3 gravestones that are set up in the corner. You have 3 women that are huddled together, shivering and in tears with absolutely no hope whatsoever. And then the lights would go out. That's chapter 1, the first 5 verses of the book of Ruth. Now, what we need to do is we need to trace the response of 3 people based upon those life situations. The response of 1 person is Naomi. That's the rest of chapter 1. The response of the 2nd person is Ruth. That's Ruth chapter 2. And the response of the 3rd person is Boaz. That's Ruth chapter 3. And then they all get brought together. That's what's really cool about this is you actually have, and as I come into a singles retreat, I really don't think about in terms of preparing something for singles. But I'll simply say this. The more I've meditated, the more I've thought about this book is about singleness because it's all about single people. Naomi's single. Ruth's single. Boaz is single. It's actually a great little book to meditate at this point in life. So, on our next session, I want to look at the response of Naomi versus the response of Ruth. And we'll bring those two thoughts together. The end of chapter 1, chapter 2. Then, in our session this evening, I want to look at the response of Boaz. And all I want to do is I'll come back to what I said at the very beginning. What does a broken life look like in normal circumstances? Because this is real life for them. What does a normal life look like? And I think we're going to see it in those three responses. All right, all introduction. Warned you about it going in. But as that sets the framework, we'll start talking about the people in our next session. Let's pray. Father, thanks for giving us all the information we need to be well-informed as we think through the Scriptures. And Lord, help us to think through the Scriptures. May we not read them as somehow divorced and detached from our own lives. But Lord, may we recognize that they are real lives, real people in real time who have some real challenges. And Father, help us to reflect upon them in such a way that their lives can become examples of both goodness and grace, and Lord, even mistakes. And Lord, may we learn from those as we progress through the day. And we'll give you thanks in your name. Amen.